Welcome to episode 194 of The Lab. I'm Brad Barton.
I'm Phil Barton.
There should be some links on the show page with more information today, which you can find by visiting thelabwithbrad.com. Right, so we're going to talk about the brain. I want to start by talking about what I've been doing. I knew I'd get to this point sooner or later with my brain, with my computer, with my digital organisms.
Oh, those guys.
Those guys. Yeah, I call them figures.
Fat babies.
Right.
It's really funny to us.
All right. Another moratorium on fat babies. Okay. I knew I'd reach this point sooner or later. These sort of experiments are resource hogs. And I've been evolving mutation resistance bit by bit, which means, amongst other things, that the better the population is doing, the longer the test takes. So in generation one, the test took 1 hour, 46 minutes, and 46 seconds. In the last run, it took 16 hours, 53 minutes, and 18 seconds.
Which was a good thing.
Good thing in a one way, but I got to add like five of these populations to test. Now, if they all come in at about the same way, we're talking about like more than 80 hours of computer time. Oh. I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about the people who did this sort of stuff originally. Like Baricelli.
Okay.
We talked about him in episode 96. And he was working on a machine in the 1950s called Maniac.
That's a good name. Okay.
A great name. It had could get up to 16 kilohertz. You compare that today to today's machines that are measured in megahertz and even gigahertz. Mm-hmm. Orders of magnitude, many orders of magnitude faster now. For memory, it had a whole whopping 5,000 bytes.
Look out.
So if he had started with my approach, he would have to have abandoned it simply because the machine couldn't handle it. But we've got modern hardware now.
Yeah. All the memory you need in the world.
All holy crap. Which brings me to things like Google's DeepMind and other such projects. I've been thinking that nobody's ever implemented as many neurons as we have. That turns out not to be the case.
Many neurons as we have, like, in our brain?
In our brain. We got about 86 billion. There have been projects that have done, I think Google had about 11 billion. Google did 500 billion. Or not Google, IBM did 500 billion in one of their projects. So as far as just raw neuron count, we have reached and even surpassed the human brain.
Okay. But they're not very smart.
But they're not very smart. So something obviously is missing. And this is where we get into the problem. It probably would not take a machine as complicated as our brain to perform the tasks that our brain does. Evolution is a sloppy designer.
Okay.
Yeah. It will use every last little trick it ever stumbles upon, ever. But we don't know what of that bewildering way, array of complexity is vital to the way we function. And what's just sort of, you know, there. So I thought I'd illustrate this point by just looking at an neuron.
Oh, cool.
One little, modest little cell.
There it sits, looking all octopus-y. Sure.
That's a word. As far as design goes, as far as evolution goes, I'm jealous of nature, who had billions of years, an entire planet, and a whole lot of water to work with. So, it got started, life, somehow, some way.
Okay.
Good, good, good. All right, so in order to talk about the neuron and how it functions, we have to talk a little bit of physics. Not much, but take an atom.
Okay.
Just one. Hold it between your thumb and forefinger somehow.
I am an amazing person right now.
With very tiny calipers.
Holding atoms.
Your classic atom would be the hydrogen atom with one proton in the nucleus with a positive charge and an electron with a negative charge floating around it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why positive and negative? Why did we get that? That was Benjamin Franklin's fault. He'd been rubbing things.
Okay.
Glass, silk, wool, cork, rubber. He was experimenting with static electricity.
Okay.
And he got the notion that there was some sort of fluid that while you were rubbing the silk against the glass rod was getting rubbed off of one and added to the other. So one would have a deficit of this fluid, thus a negative charge, and the other would have a surplus, a positive charge.
Mm-hmm.
And then he guessed and got it wrong. 50-50 shot. It's not so much a fluid as it is the electrons. They can get rubbed off or attach themselves to one atom and give up on the other one, giving these atoms a net electric charge, making them into ions.
Cool.
For example, if you have some sodium, it's not holding on to its outermost electron very hard. It doesn't really mind if that goes away.
Hmm.
Where chlorine loves all of its electrons and it would even love another one or two. So it will grab the electron from the sodium, leaving the sodium as a positive ion and turning it into a negative ion, and then they hang out together as a single ionically bound molecule of table salt, sodium chloride.
Which is tasty. Well, maybe not so much tasty. It makes things, other things tasty.
It makes things salty is what it does. Now, there are ways you can get an ion floating around by itself. Suppose you put salt in water.
Okay.
Right. Water, you've got a couple of hydrogens who actually could either take another electron or let go of the one they have. They could go either way. Mm-hmm. And they're bound to an oxygen, which absolutely wants a couple more electrons.
Mm-hmm.
The oxygen holds on to that electron a little harder than the hydrogen does, but they're sharing.
Okay.
And what you get is an oxygen that is slightly negatively charged, and two hydrogens that are slightly positively charged,
mm-hmm.
all stuck together into two hydrogens and one oxygen, a molecule of water.
Yay!
So when you drop your sodium chloride ionically bound molecule into this water, all those positive H's and negative O's will tease the two apart. So instead of being a molecule of salt, you're now going to have a positive sodium floating around and a negative chlorine floating around.
Hmm.
And this is important because without this sort of trick, none of the rest of what we're going to talk about can happen at all.
Okay.
Cells. Evolution. We talked about it being a sloppy designer. They're like complicated little factories. But if the Environmental Protection Agency ever noticed, they'd shut them down. They are sloppy, they are noisy, they are messy. In your typical factory, you're going to put your stock in one end and get your product out of the other end, along with certain waste products. In a cell, you put your product in one end, you put your stock in one end, you get the product out at the other end. The product may or may not be within spec. And at any point along the lines, the gears may toss out an incomplete product. It's just spewing and rattling and belching out toxins. But it's all good enough, right?
Yeah.
Good enough. Cells got together and they decided they'd handle the world, and they had to get various cells to specialize for various tasks. All of this needs to be coordinated.
Okay.
This requires that you can send long-distance messages, and often that you can send those messages fairly quickly.
Hmm.
The cellular factory that handles that sort of thing is the neuron.
Okay.
Doo-doo-doo.
And welcome to the neuron.
Now, when I say it's a fast message, you have to understand that they're using electric charges to send the message down their cell's body.
Okay.
But it's using ions rather than the movement of electrons. It's much slower.
Oh.
Now, electrons, typically in an electrical circuit, move at about a third the speed of light.
Pretty dang fast.
Pretty dang fast. What is it, 3 times 10 to the 10th meters per second? You get about 100 meters a second for nerve impulses. And that's the upper end of speeds. So much, much, much slower.
Doesn't seem like it.
Doesn't seem like it. Well, for your typical size critter, it's not a big deal.
You can't see it right now, but I am opening and closing my hand like a madman.
No, it's working. Yeah, still fast enough for what it does. Now, how do we power these little factories? Well, for energy to do work for you, there has to be some kind of imbalance. If you want to use a heat engine, such as a steam engine, or... well, let's just stick with the steam engine and not confuse things.
Okay.
There has to be a significant difference between the hot end and the cold end, or it won't work.
Okay.
If everything's hot, nothing runs. Ditto for cold. Okay. It's the temperature difference that drives the system. If you want to make a little hydroelectric dam, those are wonderful things. Mm-hmm. Well, then the water has to be up further than it will end up.
Okay, yeah, gravity.
Yes, hey. Yes. And another thing you can use is diffusion and entropy.
Okay.
Pause. What does that mean? Well, suppose, have you ever, somebody opens a bottle of perfume, right?
Mm-hmm.
Within moments, the entire room is filled with the hopefully pleasant smell.
Hopefully pleasant.
of that perfume. And that's because the atomized stuff, the stuff that's getting into the air, spreads around. And this is purely a sort of a statistical effect as various molecules bounce against each other. Mm-hmm. Now, if you wanted to get the perfume back in the bottle, you would have to use energy to do that. Why do I mention that? Well, because neurons do this sort of thing.
Oh, that's amazing. You got a room full of the smell. What, are you going to run around with a butterfly net? I don't know.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Now, the classic example, say you've got a mixture of, oh, I don't know, nitrogen and oxygen. Okay. And then you'd have a filter that would only allow, say, oxygen through.
Cool.
Okay. So you put that mixture on one side of it, but it won't just spontaneously go through. It takes energy. You got to put extra pressure on that side to force the oxygen and only the oxygen through the membrane.
I see. Okay.
And speaking of membranes, cells have those.
Yes, they do.
And at least for animals, just about every cell has an electrical potential across the membrane.
Which is very important.
Yes, and actively maintained with enzymes like the sodium-potassium pump.
Okay.
Yeah, it's driven by ATP, the little energy molecule.
Mm-hmm.
That is broken apart, and when it breaks apart, it flies apart from... the pieces fly apart with considerable force. And a molecule that kind of acts like a lever will grab onto one end or the other, or both. Mm-hmm. And when they snap apart, use that movement to do things that otherwise it couldn't. In this case, it's spinning a little wheel that takes 3 sodium from inside and takes them out. At the same time, it takes 2 potassium from outside and brings them in.
Neat.
And it does that. That happens once per revolution of the wheel, once for each ATP molecule used up. Of course, this is a cell, so it doesn't always work perfectly.
Mm.
But you get that's also giving you a net charge outside of the cell.
Cool.
Now, both sodium and potassium are positive ions, but there are also rather large negatively charged molecules inside the neuron. So as far as... I did read one paper that seemed to suggest that both the outside and inside are positively charged compared to I don't know, say your room.
Okay.
But the positive charge is low enough inside the cell to act like a negative charge as far as the sodium on the outside of the cell is concerned. So I'm getting a couple of different stories here. And yeah, this is starting to get to the point where you're like, yay, okay, who cares?
Exactly say that. Neurons, what are we talking
literally
about?
Inside, negative, outside, positive. That's what's happening.
The little hamster wheels that are spinning in the cell.
Those are continuous, by the way. They never quite stop. Just keep trading potassium and sodiums back and forth. That's their mission in life. And just to make things more complicated, there are four different types of that pump in mammals.
Okay.
And that's only one kind of pump. There are other pumps that will trade ions around and bring molecules along for the ride, either inside or outside. Some of them are powered by ATP. Some of them are actually powered by the voltage difference between the inside and outside of the cell. So I told you it's complicated.
This is important stuff because of stuff. What's happening here? We're trying to send a signal, right?
We are.
Okay.
So the next thing that happens, for some reason, and there's lots of different triggering mechanisms, we'll get to those in a minute, is that some ion channels open.
Okay, cool.
Now, unlike the ion pump, this is a passive mechanism. The sodium ion channels, for example, will open up if the potential difference between the outside and inside is at a certain value. Typically about 15 microvolts above the resting state.
Okay.
Right. So now it's open. So now sodiums, and only sodiums, slip through those channels.
Okay.
And the only reason they're doing that is the same reason that perfume fills the room. It's a statistical effect. It's diffusion.
Yeah, okay.
But while they're doing that, they are neutralizing the negative and shifting the inside of the cell to the positive charge.
Which is important.
Which is important, I guess. These sodium channels, some of them are voltage activated, like I said. So when they start doing this, you can get to a runaway positive feedback mechanism where the increased sodium flow increases the voltage, which opens more voltage-activated sodium channels, which increases the voltage some more.
So we're making electricity?
Yeah, we're changing, we're making a little electrical pulse. And all this just happens on one little patch of membrane. Unless the voltage difference gets strong enough to start affecting adjacent patches of membranes, which will then go through the same rigmarole. One of the things about this trick is that the voltage that gets induced is typically a lot higher than the thing that caused it. It's amplifying the signal.
Ah, okay.
Yes, and the signal strength doesn't vary by the time it gets to the end of the cell and passes the message on to the next one. It's always the same signal strength, regardless of the strength of the stimulus. If the stimulus is stronger, it fires more often.
Okay.
Yeah, and we're not done yet, because how does it turn back off? What happens is that there are some potassium channels, again, activated by voltage, that will open up at a certain point and allow potassiums, and only potassiums, to flow out of the cell.
Okay.
At which point, they neutralize the negative charge that has been building up outside of the cell. And roughly at that point, the sodium channels lock. They shut, and they shut down completely. They're like, no more of this. The potassium continues to flow out. It actually ends up at a lower voltage than its resting potential. And during this time, they call it the refractory period, that particular patch of membrane will not react to voltage differences anymore. This is important because, generally speaking, you want the signal to go in one direction.
Okay.
And the only reason it does that is because part of the cell is exhausted and won't react anymore.
Okay, I'm so tired.
Then, the potassium channels shut down. And now it's all about those pumps, which trade those potassiums back in and the sodiums back out and get it back to its original state, ready to fire again. And all of this can happen within a very brief time.
We're talking about channels and stuff. Yeah.
This was a very nautical neuron.
Okay.
Right. Neurons are capable of firing thousands of times a second, depending upon the type of neuron. This is all happening in the cell body and the axon. Electrical potential gets sort of collected by things they call dendrites, which we'll talk about in a moment, may or may not pass the threshold and cause a neuron to fire, to do this cascading domino effect of electricity down the length of the body and along the tail, which they call the axon. Yeah. And neurons, generally speaking, have one and only one axon, although it can branch hundreds or thousands of times. just to further complicate the picture.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry. Usually sodium and potassium. That's the classic example, but it can also be chlorine or calcium involved. And those are just like the big four. Where was I? I don't even remember. Right.
Dendrites collect and then an axon and branching.
Dendrites. They generally don't have voltage-gated ion channels. Their ion channels get opened like a key in a lock. Some molecule comes along, slides into the keyhole, so to speak, and turns it. And then it will open some ion channels. And if enough of that happens close enough together, this firing, they call it an action potential, takes place. To further complicate the picture.
How many times have you said that?
I don't know. I'm losing track. Yeah. There are a lot of different molecules and a lot of different chemical receptors. Some of them will open ion channels. Some of them will close ion channels. And they're all coming from other neurons. Mostly.
Mostly.
Each dendrite is met up by a bunch of axons, the tail end of other neurons, at a place they call a synapse. There's a slight gap between the cells, usually. And when a signal reaches the end of the tail, it sends across one of these chemical keys and affects the next neuron, or at least the dendrite of the next neuron.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Sometimes synapses happen between dendrites. Synapses can happen between axons. Synapses can happen between an axon and the cell body.
Okay.
I told you, it's complicated. there are also synapses that don't have a gap. The cytoplasm, the liquid inside the cell, actually communicates directly between one cell and another.
Ooh.
Called gap junctions.
Descriptive name?
Yeah, or electrical synapse. Another name. Also descriptive.
Yeah.
To further complicate the picture.
What are we doing?
Not every chemical key has to come from a synapse. Some of them are floating around, coming from neurons that are very far away, not directly connected at all. A lot of the neurons involved in emotional states sort of spray out neural transmitter all over the damn place.
It's just, here! It's like feeding pigeons.
Yeah.
This is for you. No.
Okay, I don't want to run too far with this metaphor, but I get it now. You're standing there. Here are the pigeons. Here's my I'm upset grain. Here's my bag of happy grain.
It does not run too far. Okay.
Yeah. Then the synapses change over time. In fact, not too long ago, I ran into a study that found out that they change every day. Now, while you're awake, they tend to get fatter.
Okay.
Have more receptors. And then those get trimmed back, just shrink back down as you're asleep.
Okay.
The information seems to be mostly coded in the synapses. A given synapse fires, it either makes the neuron more likely to fire. We're talking about the downstream or postsynaptic neuron.
Neat. Okay.
Or it might make it a little less likely to fire.
Okay.
You begin to see what I'm talking about. This is just the single neuron. And it's incredibly complicated.
I had this picture of, like, you know, if we can shrink down electronics so much, we should be able to make the equivalent of a neuron into a single chip. And you're really painting a picture like that is not only difficult, but impossible.
solid state physics, I'm not sure how you'd get changing synaptic sizes and patterns of activity over time.
Yeah. I mean, you'd have to have a chip with a lot of little wavy little bits that can connect up wherever they want, whenever they want.
It's all very complicated. And this isn't even, I mean, we barely touched on how it actually stores information. And that a single neuron by itself doesn't store much in the way of information, except its own internal state. It needs to be connected to many others in large circuits and networks. And you got to ask yourself, how do the neurons know where to wire up?
Yeah,
and
I do.
How does all that happen? Well, we'll talk about that next time. See you then.
Bye.